Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 2. 2 Samuel chapter 2. Civil wars are ugly and brutal and bloody things. Civil war in America was a long and bloody strife that radically changed the United States. A civil war that's been instigated by Russia that carved off the Crimea from Ukraine, an attempt to destabilize that country for its own good and for its agenda. The civil war in the Sudan between the Muslims in the north and the non-Muslims in the south, some of whom were Christians. It's a long, horrible genocide. Has actually led to the establishment of a safe zone for non-Muslims in the southern Sudan and northern Uganda. In most of these things, the media loses interest. And as a result, unless you intentionally and prayerfully investigate, look, listen, you won't know much about it. Israel has had two times in its history, in ancient history, biblical history, in which it went through a civil war, a time where the North and the South were divided. What we are about to embark on, these next two chapters, 2 Samuel 2 and 3, cover the first of these two civil wars. The second one, we're probably a little more familiar with, in the dividing of the nation into Rehoboam and Jeroboam after Solomon's death. Horrible civil war that led to the permanent partition of northern Israel from southern Judah. But what we have here in the text in front of us is a precursor of that. It's the same fault line. The time is around somewhere between 1007 BC and 1000 BC, with some evidence putting the events of this chapter right around 1005 BC. Now, we might also be helped a little bit by having some sense of where these things take place. Now, I don't know how well you can see that, but you can see the southern two tribes, which would be Judah, known as Judah, and the northern 10 tribes, which have been known as Israel. And at this time, the southern two tribes, known as Judah, followed David as king. And the 10 northern tribes, who I'm going to refer to as the north and south all through our time tonight, did not follow an establishment of King David. And so we have about 7 years, terrible, difficult time in Israel. We generally think of Saul dying and David immediately being anointed and recognized as king and assuming the throne in Jerusalem. And yet our narrative tells us that this was a fairly long process. Think back 7 years in your life, to get a sense of how long. Well, our narrator opens by giving us a picture of two kings. Now, for the later reader of Samuel, actually for whom it is written, this is a foreshadowing of the divided kingdom after Solomon. In verses 1 to 7, we have the installment of David as the king in Judah. Reading verses 1 to 7. After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." And David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. They told David, "It was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed by the Lord because you have showed disloyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Now, David's humble and submission to God is evidenced here. He has regularly sought to know the Lord's will, particularly in the timing of decisions, movements in his life. He sought the Lord in battles, in dealing with Saul, and in dealing with Israel's enemies. And now he inquires of the Lord with a question, actually is in two parts. Is this the time to go public with his rule? And should he do so in Judah? And so the Lord directs him to begin his regency, his rule, in Hebron. And we see David's careful diplomacy throughout his rise to the throne. We saw it as he tried to deal with Saul, never threatened Saul. He tried appealing and fleeing and even shaming Saul. But he did his best trying to deal with him. He had cultivated a relationship. David had cultivated a relationship and won the respect of the leaders of Judah. He had sent to each of the elders over the cities some of the spoil that he had taken for the Amalekites. He had protected Judah's borders and tried to keep the current battles from taking place in Judah, much as Robert E. Lee fought as much for Virginia as he did for the Confederacy. David cultivated a relationship and earned the respect of the Jerahmeelites and the Kenites. And they had become a source of supply and support as the years will unfold. And now he reaches deep into the heartland of Saul's territory and commends the people of Jabesh-Gilead. They had taken care to properly prepare and bury Saul and his son. And David commends them. He commends them for their loyalty. He commends them for their careful service. He promises to reward them and to respect them. And in effect, calls on them to recognize that he is king alone. That leads us then to see that in verses 8 through 11, you have the installment of Ish-bosheth as king in Israel. Reading in verse 8, but, you hear the but, the commendation of the men, the faithful men who buried Saul and took great care to do it with the proper respect and honor, but Abner. Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim and made him king over Gilead and the Israelites and the Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. Now, once again, let me pause. I'm going to remind you, be careful in your reading of the Bible to know when you are and where you are, because all Israel here is not referring to all 12 tribes. Right? We're referring to the 10 northern tribes. And in the second half of Second Kings and in Second Chronicles, you're going to have the same sin. We're going to be talking about Israel. Don't think the whole nation. In fact, he qualifies it. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Now, from the text, it appears that this civil war was more between Abner and Joab than between Ish-bosheth and David. And that's going to unfold in this and the next chapter. Abner had been the general under Saul. He had control of the army and probably the hearts of the people. He seems to have opposed the ascension of David. And fortunately, it does not appear to be because of a well-founded loyalty to Saul's household. Rather, he seems to be pursuing his own place, his own position, and his own power. He is going to become, for a short period of time, the king maker. As one commentator said, quote, "If Abner started the fire, Joab was to stir the pot that was to boil upon its coals." And notice the timelines here. David rules over Hebron over Judah 7 years and 6 months. This is the period in which he ruled over Judah before the consolidation of the kingdom and moving his throne to Jerusalem. Ish-bosheth rules over Israel for 2 years. This is a shorter period of time. What happened to the 5 years and 6 months? Right? I mean, that's the question. It appears that Abner waited 5 years to finally put Ish-bosheth on the throne, since we know from later chapters that Ish-bosheth's murder was immediately followed by all the tribes acclaiming David as king. So this 2 years of Ish-bosheth's reign were in the sixth and seventh years of David's reign. Abner appears to have been consolidating his power in the north and securing the borders against more Philistine incursions. And David and Abner do not seem do not seem concerned to respond until Abner appoints Ish-bosheth and begins to move toward Judah. We'll see that in verse 12. Warren Wiersbe writes, "People today are much like the people then. Like Ish-bosheth, there are weak people who get where they are because they have connections. Like Abner, there are strong, selfish people who know how to control and manipulate and use others to advance their own agendas. There are people like David who are prepared and anointed and equipped, but must wait for God's time before they can serve. It's not uncommon for churches and other ministries to bypass God's chosen men and women and put unqualified but connected people into places of leadership. Abner initially got what he wanted, but within a few years, he had lost it all." End quote. Two kings, and we have two warriors, verses 12 to 32. Now, the narrative is about the civil war, but largely given to us through the lens of a battle, the Battle of Gibeon. And the focus is, the reason he does this is he intends for us to focus on the two great warriors who were leading the battle, who were leading each side. Now, first, there is the contest between the armies in verses 12 through 17. I think this is kind of interesting. This is like the Olympics on steroids here. Joab and Abner, the two commanders, agree to a contest, a battle, between a limited number of warriors. Listen to verses 12 through 17. "Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon." That puts them right on Judah's border. "And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out to meet them at the pool of Gibeon." This pool was actually a large reservoir. So you shouldn't think of a cistern. You know, this is a very large reservoir, and they're camped on both sides of it. "They sat down, the one on one side of the pool and the other on the side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, 'Let the young men arise and compete before us.' Joab said, 'Let them arise.' They arose and passed over by number, 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. Each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his opponent's side so that they fell down together. Therefore, that place is called Halkathath Hazarim, which means the place of the sharp edge, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David." We are not told, we do not know the reason, but for some reason, Abner decides to move the northern army down to Gibeon, right on Judah's border. It's a provocation, any way you look at it. Joab responds by moving David's army there as well, and they're both camped on either side of the reservoir at Gibeon. A difficult day. If you've ever read letters written during the American Civil War, you know what it means to pit countrymen against one another. Joab proposes, and Abner agreed, to send 12 men from each side to battle it out in a contest. And you find both of them doing their best to try to limit casualties and to limit the carnage that often ensues in these kind of wars. But as the men pair up, each one of them stabs the other to death so that all 24 from both sides lie slain. So the armies engage one another in a fierce battle, and Joab's men soundly defeat Abner's and puts them back on the run to the northern territory. Verses 18 through 22 show us a pursuit by someone named Asahel. As Abner turns to flee, he is followed by the fastest man in Joab's army. This is one of those things in a narrative that you look at and you kind of smile about, but, you know, it's serious business. Follow along, picking up in verse 18. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was swift of foot as a wild gazelle, and Asahel pursued Abner, and as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor the left hand from following after Abner. So here's this big Jewish warrior, you know, sort of running from the battle, and here comes Asahel, running after him. Abner looked behind him and said, "Is that you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." Grab one of my guys over here. Don't grab me. Isn't that what he's saying? And Asahel would not turn aside from following. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" And he refused to turn aside, and therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out his back, and he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Joab, Abishai, and Asahel are David's nephews. Asahel was known as a fast runner. He takes out in pursuit of Joab to try to run him down and presumably to kill him. And this leads to the sort of odd scene of these two running along and Abner trying to deter Asahel from pursuing him. Not because, frankly, Abner is afraid of him, but he's afraid he will have to kill him. Abner knows he cannot outrun Asahel, but he also knows that Asahel is no match for him in combat. But Asahel will not be deterred nor persuaded, so Abner uses an old and common trick. The butt end of Abner's spear was sharpened so as to facilitate jabbing it into the ground as a spike. This is well documented outside of the Bible. And they would jab him in the ground. There's a cavalry attack, and they would have the end of their spear sharpened, and actually they would have it, they had burnt it over a fire so it was hardened. They would jab it in the ground in order to catch a cavalry charge. Or they would use it to jab in the ground and it became the center of a tent pole. And so that they would spread their tents out from this spear. So the spear was used for many things. Abner allows Asahel, begins to slow down, if you will, and allows Asahel to overtake him. And you know how it is. You're getting ready to overtake the guy. What do? I mean, you bear down. You run harder. Asahel is upon Abner, but Abner jabs the butt of his spear back, and Asahel is impaled on the spear, tumbles to the ground, and dies. The pursuing army comes upon Asahel dead in the ground and simply stops still in shock and in grief. Now, this is one of those places where you read a story and you go, Okay, what's the point? Well, the point will come in 2 weeks in the next chapter. So here is Asahel, the nephew of David, brother of Joab, he and Abishai, is dead at Abner's hand. Verse 24 through 28, though, the hostilities cease. Finally, wearied with all the slaughter, Abner persuades Joab to a ceasefire. Pick up in verse 24. But Joab and Abishai pursue Abner. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gibeah on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of a hill. Then Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" There's a sense in which said, Abner is saying, we are beaten. We are defeated. We are now close to our home, and all the people of Benjamin are standing behind me. What are you going to do? Come up this hill and slaughter us all? That's the sense of it here. Why do you keep on when it's obvious we're done? And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. So the army had stopped originally at the site of the death of Asahel. The brothers stay on the pursuit, now more focused ever on killing Abner. On a hilltop, the people of Benjamin rally around Abner, prepared to fight to defend the house of Saul. David's men have caught up with Joab, and from the hilltop, Abner challenges Joab to halt the fighting. This war between brothers is going to end in a slaughter. It is going to be bitter and horrible. How long will this continue? You have beaten us. Stop. Now, we do not know what Abner's motives are. They have the high ground for the battle, but it is a voluntary militia at best that he has, and they are facing skilled, battle-hardened warriors under a ruthless commander. But his words bring Joab up short. Abner's question causes Joab to blow the trumpet to stop the pursuit and turn his men towards home. What a sight. In verses 29 through 32, both armies head home to their kings and to their families. Verse 29, and Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah, which is a desert area. They crossed the Jordan, and marching the whole morning, they came to Mahanaim. Joab returned in the pursuit of Abner, from the pursuit of Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing from David's servants 19 men, besides Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. And they took up Asahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which is at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. Now, the narrator has arranged this in a little bit of a mini parallel structure. Tony, can you bring that up for me? Thank you. And notice there's Abner's return with his army, and then Joab's return of his army at the beginning and the end. Abner travels all night and in the morning to return to their northern capital. They have to cross the Jordan and all. Joab returns with his army. He marches all night and he arrives at Hebron. But in between is the tally of the losses from both sides. Joab's men lost the 12 contestants and 7 other men and Asahel. But Abner had lost 360 men, all of the tribe of Benjamin. Asahel was buried in his hometown of Bethlehem. And Joab marches all night and he arrives at Hebron. And in a beautiful, evocative phrase, they arrive just as the morning is breaking. Just an interesting way of putting it. So this battle is now over. The division between the north and south, between the two kings and the two generals, will continue for a pace. But for now, a kind of peace will exist until God's sovereign providences unite the tribes under David. Now, I want us to reflect and respond to several things in this text. First, most of Israel had rejected God's anointed and appointed king. They followed Abner and his puppet king. They rejected David and his God-ordained rule. So it should come as no surprise that from the beginning to the end of his earthly life, Jesus' proper rule and reign were rejected by most of the Jews. And second thing I note here is that rebellion against the Lord may result in division between brothers. The ensuing conflict led to physical carnage in Israel. Judas had his own agenda for Jesus, and when that agenda was not being served, he turned against the Lord and betrayed him. And things like this may happen in the church. Personal agendas and spiritual rebellion may bring conflict in the church, which may result in spiritual carnage. We must stand for truth regardless. We must also be careful that our standing is really not just a pursuit of our own agenda and purpose and power. I guarantee you that in Abner's heart and mind, what he did, he felt was right. And thirdly, note that Joab is willing to break off the battle so as to cause to cease the conflict and to provide for the possibility of a peace. Here, two warriors halt the carnage and seek peace between the brothers. Jesus calls us to be at peace among ourselves. This is not necessarily the absence of differences or discussions or possibly even conflict, but it is certainly a poise to end the conflict easily and quickly. We should have a peacemaking orientation. Brothers and sisters, until the true King, the Lord Jesus, assumes his rightful throne, there will be conflict. The world is conducting a civil war against the true king. They are following the usurper, the dark prince of the air, the shadow of light. But there will be a glorious day when Jesus will rule and reign, and the war will be over. May that day come, oh, so very soon. Let's pray. Thank you for your word. Thank you for its stories that you, through a narrator, have crafted for us, that we might observe and learn and grow, that we might walk in ways that are pleasing to you and turn away from ways that are not. And Father, I pray that we will be fiercely loyal to the true King, the great King, our Lord Jesus, until he comes and put all rebellion to an end and brings peace and vindicates his name and rules and reigns in the new heavens and the new earth. We long for that day.